thank you everyone for coming back after that fantastic session. I hope you've had a bit of time for your mental digestion and your physical digestion. And we're going to begin the mid-morning session with Maurice Reardon. Maurice is a fantastic poet, latest book, The Water Stealer. He's also the editor of Poetry Review. And he's here today to talk about Yeats. Please welcome Maurice Reardon.
Thank you, Judith. Thank you all. And thank you, Noir and Jerry, for a splendid morning thus far. We'll ease up now, I think. Yep. Is this on? Yeah. Yeats and the Unconscious. A poem from his early 20s. W.B. Yeats writes, "To him who ponders well my rhymes more than their rhyming tell of things discovered in the deep where only bodies laid asleep." Things discovered in the deep. Yeats' province was the hidden, the occult, in a quite undiscriminating sense, all that lay beyond the conscious mind. So it would be ambitious of me to try to do any justice to such a subject this morning, and to do so here in this temple to mistakes and false memories, forgetting names, dodgy jokes, parapraxies, is that the right word? It'd be an invitation to disaster, I think. So I give myself a limited remit, essentially to look at into one Yeats poem. It's a great and a well-known one, Lead and the Swan, and to see what might be deep in it. But first I will chance some sort of broad sweeps and swipes. W.B. Yeats was born 150 years ago, and Freud was born 159 years ago, so they were near contemporaries, and they died in the same iconic year, 1939, and both, being icons of the age, were commemorated in elegies by W.H. Auden. Now, Yeats was, like Freud, a psychic researcher. He spent a lifetime of involvement with the occult, magic, folklore, astrology, seances, mysticism, automatic writing, definitely, you name it, and of course, dreams. I should say, in all fairness, that his approach was quasi-scientific. It was investigative. He wanted to prove the existence of the soul, to prove the existence of a spiritual realm, and in doing so, to disprove his father's atheism and materialism. So he was kind of, sort of unusual in being a Victorian who rebelled against atheism and materialism. Was Yeats aware of Freud? Well, the answer to that is indeed yes. Yeats was a member of the Society for Psychical Research, and it was in the proceedings of the Society for Psychical Research in November 1912 that Freud published a note on the unconscious. So WBY would surely have perused this, though I doubt he gave it close attention. I'm going to quote just briefly from Freud's a note on the unconscious. The unconscious, what's the word, designates not only latent ideas in general, but especially ideas with a certain dynamic character, ideas, keeping apart from consciousness in spite of their intensity and activity. So that's kind of the revolutionary distinction, I think, isn't it? The ideas are hidden from conscious, but nonetheless, they are active and powerful and manifest themselves in, well, neurotic symptoms, often, obviously, but also in everyday ways, such as slips of the tongue, forgetting names, the mistakes, the misrememberings, and, of course, in dreams, which obviously can be interpreted so as to make manifest their disguised import. And we have been talking, I suppose, quite a bit, referring to poems and how they relate to dreams and whether they are, in a sense, dreams or waking dreams, perhaps. That's my sort of license, or that's the license, I suppose, of anybody bringing Freud to a poem. Lieder and the Swan. Which you probably all know, but I'll read it anyway. Well, I can read it here, I guess, can't I? A sudden blow, the great wings beating still above the staggering girl, her thighs caressed by the dark webs, her nape cut in his bill. He holds her helpless breast upon his breast. How can those vague, how can those terrified, vague fingers push the feathered glory from her loosening thighs? And how can body, laid in that white rush, but feel the strange heart beating where it lies? A shudder in the loins engenders there the broken wall, the burning roof and tower, and Agamemnon dead, being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air, that she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop. It's obviously a poem that has a sexual force field, and we do kind of pick that up straight away, but also it has a kind of, it has a definite complicated setting. Yeats actually stated that he wrote the poem in response to a request for a political poem. And there is a dimension of the poem that sort of is present in that, and I just kind of get that out of the way first. Yeats had a cyclical understanding of history. It went in 2,000-year cycles. Each cycle was initiated by an encounter between the divine and the human. So the Christian epoch began over 2,000 years ago now, with the Holy Ghost impregnating Mary. And Yeats saw it as coming to an end in the 20th century, and that a new cycle was about to start. And that's the poem that you know as the Second Coming. I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast its hour come round at last slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. So that a new, more savage age, he predicted, was going to come into existence in the 20th century. But before the Christian era, that was preceded by the Homeric cycle. And that began when Zeus raped Leda in the form of a swan, and Leda then gave birth to, a number of children, but to Helen of Troy and Clytemnestra, and this kind of myth of union between the divine and the human had a kind of personal resonance for Yeats himself, because he, in his own kind of personal mythology, Maud Gonne was Helen of Troy. In an earlier poem, No Second Troy, he ascribes his failure to marry Maud Gonne to the historical period, historical phase we are now in. Was there another Troy for her to burn? But this role of Maud Gonne in his private mythology as Helen of Troy is not it didn't stay fixed. It's a bit complicated. Is this working okay? Yeah. Okay. By him wishing to marry Maud Gonne's daughter Isolde, and of course that would make her Helen in a sense, and it would make Maud Gonne Leda, and in fact that kind of shift of roles is suggested in a poem from approximately the same time as Leda and the Swan. It's among school children, where, you know, he's in the schoolroom, and presents himself as a 60-year-old smiling public man. And then rather shockingly, he is seeing in his mind a Ledean body. And that is to say, it's Maud Gonne appears before him as a child. So there are a few other references, if you like, to that kind of his own personal sort of mythology. Later in that poem, he writes of himself, "I had pretty plumage once," as indeed he had. And it just momentarily brings to my mind anyway that he wore a new white suit when he went to woo Isolde Gonne. Well, but leave those kind of suggestions on the margins, kind of hovering over the poem. We won't allow them to press too heavily on it. But I would like to poke at the poem rather intrusively in another way. Can you actually see it okay there? Yeah, from the corner sides and so on. I haven't rewritten it. I've just highlighted a few words in here and there. The term punctum comes to mind. Maybe these are kind of pinholes that will allow us sort of to look a little bit more deeply or poke more deeply into the poem. One thing just generally, it's a sonnet, let me say that. It's quite obviously a sonnet, but it's also a sonnet that's been, so to speak, struck by lightning, you know, leaving this fracture at line 11. Other than that, it is basically an iambic, it is an iambic pentameter. Ti-tum, 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 ti-tum. Though there are quite a few kind of subtle variations on that. Well, not so subtle, but variations on it. Yeats himself didn't count. Yeah, his friend and associate George Russell said to the young Joyce, when Joyce had some question about Yeats's metrics, he said Yeats and I didn't count. But if we count, we see above the staggering girl. Yeah, above the staggering girl. So it's a bit. You can reduce the staggering to two syllables, but you know it. You have to make a bit of an effort to do that. Above the staggering girl. Yeah. So it's not quite ti-tum. Yeah. And then There's another example of that from her loosening thighs. Yeah? The feathered glory from her loosening thighs. And that's quite sort of, what shall I say, inactive or suggestive, let's say. Suggestive is the appropriate word, I think, in this context. I kind of draw attention to that because you get a couple of examples of that, but then you get quite a bit of it in the last line before the indifferent beak could let her drop. Yeah, before the indifferent beak could let her drop. Before the indifferent beak could let her drop. Okay, it's quite tricky metrically. Stress, and definitely stress at the end, yeah. But it's actually got 12 syllables overall, so you've got quite a few of those kind of rocking ones. And you are confused by the let her, yeah. To do it regularly, you would say, could let her drop, yeah. So, her would be light. She'd be dropped, yeah? But it could also go, could let her drop, yeah? So there is a kind of rocking, metrical effect there. And of course, I suppose again it is kind of suggestive that, the poem ends with the word drop, yeah? Which is, I don't know, suggestive of it's post-ejaculatory suggestive, yeah. And the word drop is just one O short of droop. Well, it is the Freud Museum after all. Okay. So, good to turn to the words in red, a sudden blow. So I suppose there is a blow is a violent force, a violent strike. Sometimes a blow in one's life is a kind of calamity. But also, of course, the word it applies to a gust of wind, a blow of wind, a gust of wind. And as such, it should be It is inspirational. It was for Yeats, as for the Romantics, as in his rewrite of Frost at Midnight, A Prayer for My Daughter. The wind is howling at the beginning. Yeah, it's an inspirational wind. Inspirational, of course, is also has suggestions of impregnation. The angel Gabriel, you know, in initiating the Christian era, blew in Mary's ear. You know, that was often represented in the paintings. And you might wonder if I'm sort of overdoing things here, and I probably am, but I'm going to point out to you that Yeats said to his Harley Street doctor surgeon who performed a rejuvenating operation on him, he said, "I lack inspiration." And by that, he didn't mean that he couldn't write. He was referring to his impotence. I've sort of highlighted nape there, perhaps for no good reason, except it seems such a strange sort of word, you know, to actually, rather than neck or something, such a strange word. And then you think, you know, there is the rhyme with rape. So I just kind of thought maybe that would be worth sort of drawing attention to. And then I have drawn attention to Bill, And maybe I shouldn't have done that, but Yeats said, I find my Christian name detestable. His Christian name being William, yeah, and of course Bill is a version of William. But I think he was thinking of the name that his family and so on generally applied to him, and that was Willie, yeah. So he didn't like being called Willie Yeats. He said, "Call me Yeats," or he often signed himself WBY. Now, okay, the feathered glory. Well, I think I'm justified in pointing to that because it's important, I think, to activate the slang meaning of glory, as in morning glory. I'm sure you all know the slang meaning of glory. So that kind of make, otherwise the line would be quite difficult, really. Yeah, the feathered glory, but it is actually the erect penis of the swan, yeah? Mm-hmm. So, there are various kind of little things one could point to, but I just come back to the end. Yeah, it's framed as a rhetorical question. Being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air, that she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop. Now, that line, "that she put on his knowledge with his power," that's the question, isn't it? And I'd be grateful for enlightenment about this line. You know, I just don't really know. I don't get it. It's partly because of that word "put on." I mean, you put on a dress, you put on an accent, you put on a weight, you put on weight rather, you put on a face, you pretend, but you don't really put on power, do you? Or put on knowledge. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm completely wrong, but I feel that it's something of a red herring, that line, yeah? "That she put on his knowledge with his power," because the actual force of the whole question, of the whole sentence, is actually inactive, I think. Yeah, the force of it is so mastered by the brute blood of the air before the indifferent beak could let her drop. Mm-hmm. It's a casting off of the of Leda, yeah, by the power of the bird, yeah, which is kind of, I think anyway, somewhat disguised by that rhetorical question. Those are some of the things that, you know, I think are perhaps latent in the poem, but are active in it, and that give it its violent energy. That seems, I mean, the poem has created a fair amount of controversy. The Dublin Catholic Bulletin referred to it as Yeats's foul swan poem. and it's continued, you know, to provoke people because of this element of, that it seems to enact a rape fantasy, and that this is very personal to Yeats, and that it does have to do with his well, perhaps with his failures in relation to both Maud Gonne and Isolde Gonne. But I'd like to, you know, sort of in the time remaining to me, let me check how much time there is remaining to me.
10 minutes.
10, is it? Yeah. Oh, okay. But we started late.
The 4 minutes for questions.
Okay. I'll quicken the pace a bit. Okay, so as I say, it has that kind of force, but everything in WBY involves opposites. The masterful images, yeah, but out of what began, as he writes himself, a mound of refuse or the sweepings of a street in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart, yeah. This is poetry of command, it's rhetorical, stanzaic, equestrian, is the result of remaking the self as its opposite. He views this kind of pursuit of your opposite as characteristic of the artist. One memorable example he gives is of Keats. I see a schoolboy when I think of him, with face and nose pressed to a sweet shop window. And yet, though Keats is this kind of deprived young man, he makes luxuriant song. So if you apply that to Yeats, you can see perhaps why he makes phallic song. Yeah, his own in actuality, his weak part was his penis. He experienced impotence in youth, and again, in more expectedly, I guess, in age. And as I said, he told his Harley Street surgeon he lacked inspiration and had an operation which apparently had a psychological effect anyway. But this was a problem for him. And just more generally, W.B. Yeats' own self, again to use his own words, is timid, entangled, empty, and abashed. You know? So it is that kind of abject side we see behind the mask, perhaps. Yeah? I will just kind of say a little bit more about that and refer to the one indisputable manifestation of his unconscious that I'm going to refer to. On the morning of January the 14th in 1936, and Yeats would then have been 70, Mrs. Yeats was woken in Dublin by oh of pain from her husband. And so she rushed next door, only to realize that he wasn't there. He was in Majorca, where he had in fact fallen seriously ill. So I'm glad somebody used the word uncanny earlier. He remained sick in a critical condition for some weeks. And at some point during that illness, I'd like to think it was in the morning when his wife heard the oh, but anyway, he called out from his delirium, George, call the sheriff. Now, George was, in fact, Mrs. Yeats. She was born Georgie Hydelees, but early in their marriage, Yeats took to calling her George. And it's a fair summary, I think, to say that her role in his life was often that of the person who summoned the sheriff, or perhaps was the sheriff. The role was to bring law and order to a life that wasn't exactly chaotic, but it was nomadic and overactive, and it was beset by powerful emotional entanglements. On this occasion, in 1936, George travelled to Majorca to take care of her husband, and while there, she saw off a certain Mrs. Foden, who was causing a lot of disruption And at least one can speculate that the summons to call the sheriff was to get rid of this pest. Yeah. But that was a minor intervention compared to what had happened early in their marriage 20 years earlier, when, you know, on their honeymoon, Yeats was ill with guilt and emotional conflict because of a feeling primarily that he had betrayed three women, Isolde gone, Maud gone, and also his new wife. And in this crisis, George resorted to automatic writing. And this proved to be, this saved the marriage. Yeah. The result was spectacularly effective. It did sort of ward off the twin threat of Maud and assault to the marriage. But also, she accessed a whole occult world of symbols. And Yeats, for several years, drew on this. He drew in on it as a metaphor for his poems, and also to develop his mature here in the sense of fully developed. Yeah, his mature system of, if you like, philosophy encompassing history and human typology that eventuated in his book A Vision. And it enabled him, if you like, to achieve this kind of mastery. There's nothing fragmentary about Yeats. You know? It's all hammered, as he said, into a unity. And he had a sense of achievement and of succeeding in doing this by fully inhabiting the mask, as he put it. Yeah. A part of that mask is sexual potency. Mm? So that in his later years he saw himself as the wild old wicked man. He said he was experiencing a strange second adolescence. And this, you know, this sort of this results in Yeats's poetry being almost comically phallic, I think, yeah? And aspects of his life are almost comically phallic. At age 52, he renovated an Anglo-Norman tower for George, yeah? And as he says, decked and altered it for a girl's love. So when he was there, he climbed the winding stairs of the tower to write at a table that had a sword on it, a ceremonial sword, a samurai sword. Yeah. So in fact, it is comically phallic, and he's not unaware of this. Malachi Stiljack am I, he says, yeah, in self-mockery. But I do want to just kind of point out that this kind of reflects back on Leda and the Swan, that his kind of phallic weaponry is symbolic. Mm? We've gone the wrong way. Where is that? Oh, going the right way now. Yeah. So I'll conclude by by showing you a couple of his phallic weapons. the painted chair leg is his Golden Dawn wand, which he fashioned himself when he was enrolled as an adept into the Golden Dawn. One of the things it's one of his four elemental weapons. And actually the other one is Sato's sword. Nobody seemed to know what happened to Sato's sword for a long time. I read somewhere that it had gone rusty. through neglect, but there it is, looking shiny enough. And you can see it at the Yeats exhibition that's on in Dublin, at the National Library, if you have a chance to be in Dublin. So the weapons are symbolic, yeah? But just to kind of extrapolate generally from that, symbols for poets, yeah? And supremely for W.B. Yeats, symbols are potent. Thank you.
We've got time for one, possibly two questions.
Yes, would it be possible to have Zalida back?
To have what?
On the screen. I always had a certain understanding of the 13th line, and I just wonder what you would think about it.
Oh, yeah.
The, could we have the...
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
The way I thought was that Lida is approached by Zeus in his full knowledge of what he wants and what he expects to be happening. And I think in this 13th line, the poets wonder, would she, in the process of what was happening, when she was just simply overpowered, would she perhaps put on the knowledge of what he was after as something which perhaps was her knowledge now as well? I don't know whether I express myself.
No, that's brilliant. Foreknowledge, yeah. It's foreknowledge of the whole nightmare of the cycle, yeah. So that she becomes
She becomes her partner in what's happening.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very, interesting way of looking at it, yeah. I mean, it's foreknowledge then, yeah. Still a bit skeptical about it.
can I add something?
Yeah.
Looking at this poem, which I know well,
which we can't see, sorry.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. It occurred to me, who is Yeats identifying with?
Mm.
And although, yes, we do know that his sexual history was very troubled in all sorts of ways, his sexual imagination was fantastic.
Mm.
And I find the elaboration of the erotic fantasy actually very, very appealing.
Mm.
You know, I want to be laid in a white rush.
Mm.
You know, what... You know,
good for you, yeah.
You know, what I mean to say is, rape fantasies can be very thrilling. And I was wondering whether is Yeats leader?
Is he leader?
Yeah.
He does say, "I was never of a Lydian kind" in that other poem. I have to say that, but
we can all go for that.
I think it is interesting. I mean, it conflicts with the mask. Yeah, but I do think that Yeats's poetry is at its most powerful. Let's use that word. When the mask and the anti-mask are in conflict, when one is kind of interfering with the other, then when there is that kind of dynamic. So the force of it is, I mean, but people have come up with different things, you know, so, in relation, you know, where the force of it comes from. But just maybe to corroborate that a little bit, I know that in the later phase, he was kind of his life. He was interested in androgyny, yeah. With Dorothy Wellesley, he had a kind of an erotic relationship. You know, maybe not a very physical one, but it was erotic, and she was lesbian, and he sort of he was explicit about feeling a kind of a sense of being female himself in relation to her. So yeah, that's certainly something in it, I think. Yeah. Mm.
May he not be both, neither and
strong. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's the kind of territory we're in, I think, yeah, where borders, strict borders, are broken down, yeah.
So, unfortunately, I think you'll have to take Morris up on his offer to explore Yeats's weaponry over at lunchtime. And thank you for... we were all sitting here waiting. When are you going to say about the vague fingers, the vague thin, vague in? But anyway, you left it.
Can I just say it? Yeah. Okay, so vague is very puzzling until you remember it's... it can mean wild, frantic, wandering. Yeah, so it's actually quite brilliant when you think through the word a little bit. Yeah, it's not just non-specific. It is kind of the hands like that. Yeah, okay.
So thank you very much, Morris Riordan. So we now. I'm just going to rearrange the furniture in a bit of multitasking. Next up, we have psychoanalytic doubling. We have Dr. Ron Britton in conversation with two people. We have the poet Beatrice Garland, and we have the psychoanalyst Caroline Garland. And we will see who we have speaking with us today. Please welcome Beatrice Garland, Caroline Garland, and Ron Britton.
You do it. You've done it.
We solved the problem by turning it on. I think you can hear me now, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah?
Can you hear me?
Are you turned on? Well,
I don't know. Keep your Yeatsian stuff out of this.
Yeah.
Is it on, in fact? Can you hear me?
Have you turned it off?
I don't know.
Did you press anything? No, there you go. That's
it. All right. So now can you hear me?
No. Okay, what number? Okay. Have another go.
What does it sound like now? Okay, thank you.
Okay, good. Well, it's my privilege to have an interview with Beatrice Garland. It's my privilege, in fact, to know her in three different ways, really. As Caroline Garland, who's a colleague, psychoanalytic colleague, as Beatrice Garland, the poet, and as Caroline Beatrice, who's a friend. And she is one person, I should add, very much. one person, but it's as if, like a house, she can occupy different rooms and speak from different rooms. She's got a consulting room, and there she's Caroline Garland, the psychoanalyst. I think as Beatrice, she speaks from all over the place, sometimes on a riverbank, sometimes quite often in a garden, roaming around, I'd say, and relating wherever she finds herself. But it's Beatrice we're wanting to address today. So I think the quickest way to get involved in that is to ask Beatrice to read a poem.
Okay, I'll start with a poem. And I've chosen this one in the last 10 minutes because it links with Jerry's story of the psychopathic father of his child patient who was afraid to go to sleep because he thought he might die. This is called The Delivery. I have become my own night watchman. I'm waiting for a delivery of sleep, but the truck's red taillights are still down in the valley, vanishing as the road turns its back on me again. I must be the last stop on its round. In the old days, there was always plenty, a free good distributed to the poor, like air or water. Buckets winched from subterranean caverns, wells that refilled easily, silently, no queues, no waiting. Even on days when the dry heat stilled the agitations of the crickets and lured the somnolent snakes outdoors, we knew without thinking there'd be plenty that night, and the next we could be profligate, splash it around. Now I watch the Big Dipper tilting a glittering panful of sleep towards those who must not sleep, but those who must not drink, the night sister at her station in the darkened ward, the shadowy man in the control tower, the lorry drivers in their moonlit cabs, and I envy them their wakefulness, as I envy the dog-tired, the labourers, the merchant seamen, the firefighters, streaming down to the shore, sleepwalking, silent, heads filled with wants and stratagems. From far off, gears engage on the hill. The headlights come bumping towards me. I'm dry-mouthed and suddenly afraid, not wanting this sleep to be the last, drowning, not dreaming, or dreaming of something I shall never remember.
Go on.
Okay. I wanted to switch away from being the poet just for a moment to talk about a view of the unconscious that was put forward this morning, which is that it's somehow something you can only find through dreams or through waking thoughts. Because I don't know what you think, Ron, but my view is it's there all the time and you can't get away from it. And I actually want to tell an anecdote about... It's not quite an anecdote, it's a view of my father, who was a scientist and a man who detested psychoanalysis. It's amazing that I became an analyst. One of his many scathing phrases about it was that it was a dinosaur in the history of ideas. Nevertheless, this man who did not like psychoanalysis had an unconscious, even if he didn't know about it, and he didn't want to know about it. And this dawned on me, I suppose, about 10 years ago, after his death, when I realized that he, as a child, was a migrant, an immigrant, a refugee, sent to England to boarding school at the age of 6 from Brazil, which is where he was born, the son of an English mother and a Lebanese father. And he had a hard time there. He was picked, he looked different. He was very tall, very dark, and very fierce. And he was picked on there, and it became a kind of obsession of his, no, not an obsession, a preoccupation of his to be accepted by the English, and particularly by the English establishment. And he did, in fact, achieve this. Now, when I tell you that his life's work, for which he got the highest honours you can get in the science, was about repairing the body when particular organs went wrong, and getting the body, the host culture, that is, to accept foreign tissue, a donor organ, that was his life's work. And it addressed a real external problem, but it also solved an internal problem for him. And I think that is an unconscious process. And I think it infused his life and his work. But I could never have said that to him, because I would have been sent out of the room. that particular room.
Well, you found your way into this one, of course. In retaliation, almost, I would say. But I do have a sense of a great deal of biology in your poetry. So there's a sense of your father as a presence, I think, in looking at a world biologically, actually, quite a lot. He was a great biologist, he got the Nobel Prize for it. And I think one senses there is that his skepticism about psychoanalysis, some of which is very well-informed skepticism, I think, is something that is a pity that you couldn't have argued it with him later when you knew more about it. But I do think he's present in your poetry.
Well, I'm not really in a position to answer that, because if he's there, it's as the result of unconscious processes. Mm. And if there's one thing you can't do, it's analyse your own poetry. Mm. In, for instance, the brilliant way that Morris analysed Leda and the Swan. That's why we have workshop groups. I can see one of my fellow workshop members there now, because we can see it in each other's poetry, but we cannot see it in our own. And I suppose that my father and indeed my mother are there more or less consciously. Actually, there is a poem in which I think my father is there probably unconsciously, but I can't quite say how. Maybe you can say how. Shall I read it?
Mm.
It's a poem I'm very proud of, in a way, for one particular reason, which is that it's been chosen to be part of the GCSE syllabus. And so this year's crop of children are reading it and thinking about it. And I wrote it because, as a psychoanalyst, I was extremely puzzled by the growing phenomenon of young men who are willing to blow themselves up in the service of a cause. It seems to me puzzling in that, as Freud said, our greatest fear is annihilation anxiety. It's of the five anxieties, it's the most profound. And I rather agree with that, speaking for myself. But these boys, these kids, don't feel it, or if they do, they overcome it. And when trying to think about it in relation to a couple of young men that I was seeing, I thought, well, of course this has happened before. And it happened in World War II. So this poem is Kamikaze. It's about a woman who is talking to her children about her father and about her father's memory of his father. Involves a certain amount of poetic license, which I know is something we've thought about. Maybe we can all think about, but Kamikaze. Her father embarked at sunrise with a flask of water, a samurai sword in the cockpit, a shaven head full of powerful incantations, and enough fuel for a one-way journey into history. But halfway there, she thought, recounting it later to her children, he must have looked far down at the little fishing boats strung out like bunting on a green-blue translucent sea, and beneath them, arcing in swathes like a huge flag waved first one way, then the other in a figure of eight, the dark shoals of fishes flashing silver as their bellies swiveled towards the sun, and remembered how he and his brothers, waiting on the shore, built cairns of pearl-grey pebbles to see whose withstood longest the turbulent inrush of breakers, bringing their father's boat safe, yes, grandfather's boat, safe to the shore, salt-sodden, awash with cloud-marked mackerel, black crabs, feathery prawns, the loose silver of white bait, and once a tuna, the dark prince, muscular, dangerous. And though he came back, my mother never spoke again in his presence, nor did she meet his eyes. And the neighbours, too, they treated him as though he no longer existed. Only we children still chattered and laughed, till gradually we too learned to be silent, to live as though he had never returned, and that this was no longer the father that we loved. And sometimes, she said, he must have wondered which had been the better way to die. Now, I don't know why my father is in that, but he is.
I think several fathers, actually. Many fathers.
I mean, maybe because at the height of his powers, aged 54, he had a catastrophic stroke and fell. Although he continued to work afterwards, it was never quite the same.
I would have said that he was there in the biology in there too.
What's the biology in it?
Well, how about all this detail you lovingly produce?
Yes.
About what's in the sea?
Yes.
What's on the shore?
Yes.
As you often do, actually, in your poems. You attend to natural detail.
Well, natural detail, I mean, the natural world, it's one of the great sources of inspiration, isn't it? You breathe it in and it sustains you, and then you breathe it out again in a poem. Sex, death, and nature, which contains both.
Yeah, in that sense, though, you're something of an outdoor poet, aren't you?
Yes.
And that's why I often think of Wordsworth in relation to you. Because he used to write outdoors and return home and read what, or recite rather, what he'd been making. Mm. And I often had the sense that you're thinking poetry outdoors too.
Yes, yes. In fact, I have to go outdoors and often be completely on my own in order to write. Not in order to write or to edit poems, but to start a new poem. And that is not a night thought. There's something about me that rather distrusts poems that are dreams that have been converted into poems. I don't know why. I have, in fact, written a poem about dreaming, which I suppose you could say is both a poem and a psychoanalytic view. But just to go outdoors and really look at what you see, I like that. I'll read Just Me and the Cat. This is about the difficulty for all of us, I think, all human beings, that is, of living in the present, of being in the present, not memory, not thinking about the past, not desire, thinking about the future. So this is Just Me and the Cat, in France, in fact. The cat is not troubled by when. His ear is tuned to now, flicking to catch the rustle in the quaking grass. Flattening his back, he listens. All of him is now round-eyed, stiff-whiskered, focused on what he cannot see. He's making his move, lethal, elastic, has a mouse in the trap of his jaws. He sets it down with a terrible tenderness and waits as it skitters about, He's not hungry. This is merely the business of now. He bites it in half and licks himself clean. I want my day to be filled with now, taking time to look at the sky, the fresh-shorn tufts of cloud, heaped up, uncarded, and up above, something more worked, a fine grey shawl with edgings of pink, stretched to tearing by a high-up wind that I cannot hear, or needing a fire, facing the chainsaw's metallic grin, its casual verve as it rips through wood, seeing a thin flame swallow dry leaf, twig, become confident, red, as it finds the log. Does the cat lay his ear to the earth to know far off the movements of mice, put his ear to the tree for the heart of a bird? My hearing is muffled by waiting, my seeing by thinking. I have learned to be human, to walk upright, to use words.
Well, I'm thinking when you read that also of the shift you make, presumably, and that's what we could best refer to, from yourself thinking as a thinker in your consulting room, for instance, trying to attend to, imagine, and conceive of the thinking of this other person, this patient.
Yes.
What a different starting point that is than the way you write your poetry. So there's something about the different place, as I tend to think of it, from which you do. There is an intermediate position that did occur when I was thinking about this, of you in your consulting room on the one hand, and you as the outdoor poet, as I imagined you. And that is that you also do some psychoanalytic writing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that must also be starting from a very different place than Beatrice does.
Yes.
That's, we might say, you're not only in the consulting room and in all the other rooms in the house, the bedroom, the kitchen, and so on, which you inhabit, but also the study. And I'm thinking of the writing, psychoanalytic writing at that point. What does the starting point of the two situations feel like? In what sense do you start, as it were, from somewhere different?
Well, a piece of psychoanalytic writing, that is to say, a piece of writing about a problem or patients, would start from noticing something in a patient and thinking, what's that? You know, is this patient a potential suicide bomber or not? Are they still functioning as a human being in all ways that we think, and clearly not, otherwise they wouldn't be patients. The starting point there is an intellectual curiosity. Now, that a rational thought, and it's quite different from what, from the punctum that comes up, or actually, it doesn't so much penetrate me from outside, it comes up from inside and pokes its head out in some way, or it shines a little light out. And I suppose in the consulting room, when you're listening, and I mean really listening to what a patient is saying, and you are listening with every sensory modality you've got, perceptual modality you've got, that sometimes moments like that happen, but they are all focused towards the other. They are all about the other. And the reason that I began to write poetry, which was very late in terms of being a poet, is because I had the thought, but this is what I feel, not what they feel. I want to say what I feel, and so it became a vehicle for being myself. And it's why, incidentally, I continue to use my first given name for analytic work and analytic writing. And I reserve the second name, which is also my name, for poetry, because I did not want my patients to know that I was this other person or as deeply involved with the things I was involved with. And I wanted the two separate, and they've always been separate for me. There were two. This is the first time we've appeared together. Yes. Although there was a fairly hair-raising moment in a City University class of Michael Donaghy's, who had a marvellous kind of relaxed attitude to everything that went on. The new term's students arrived, and I was sitting there sort of looking forward to the term getting over again, and there walked in a patient. And Michael said, OK, let's go around the room and introduce ourselves. Beatrice, why don't you start? And I watched my patient have a meltdown at that moment. And actually, fortunately for her and for me, this was a patient I had in a group, which is a way of working I like very much and believe in very strongly. And she came into the group next week and said, guess what I saw, and talked about it. And the others sort of helped her digest it and process it. I spoke to her after that class and said, look, I don't think we can be in the same class. And Michael Donaghy runs another class on a Thursday evening. Why didn't you go to that one? And I was quite firm about it because I couldn't have continued. Yeah.
Well, you're not a reticent poet, are you?
No. No.
So if people are going to know who's written these poems, they're going to know quite a lot about this person.
Yeah.
Or moments in the life of this person, I think.
Yes, that's right. So I kept it...
Which is almost a complete contrast to the analytic position of non-self-disclosure, isn't it?
Yes. And I think the non-self-disclosure is very important because you become different. You don't become, but in the patient's mind, they start to feel about you the way they felt originally about very important people in their lives. And if you are too open about yourself, as the Americans tend to be, I don't know about you, Noah, but no. No.
There's Google.
But curious enough, Google... I mean, Google makes no link between Caroline and Beatrice at all. Yeah. And that's why I used a different name. But Google doesn't really tell anything of any significance. It tells public events, doesn't it? No, you're looking unhappy.
It certainly doesn't tell the sort of private events that your poems do.
It doesn't.
That's for sure. But you do choose to do that, don't you? And you do it with... I think the confident sense that poets have, that it's of universal relevance. I think it's a very interesting thing that, particularly since the Romantic poets, the assumption that they can inform humanity about itself by writing about themselves and from within themselves, which must imply common humanity, of course, which is very much in the poet. And I was taken by one of your poems, which you call Life.
Yeah.
Are you willing to read it to us? Because I'll tell you something about it that I made a mistake. I thought you were writing, having met a person, and having an imaginary encounter with the thinking of this imaginary person serving a life sentence. But you weren't. That's so interesting. You were imagining what it would be to be such a person, I think.
I don't want to call it imagining, because it was more like being.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll read it. Life. It's a poem about murder, I ought to warn you. Last night I woke, still thinking we were friends, as though those scenes had never been. Odd how completely... With what clarity the old designs impose themselves at night, as though that gesture with the opinel, that one blind push, through, unexpectedly, a tender stuff, silk, not canvas, and into something warm and wet and brightly coloured, had been, as in a dream, problem-solving at a stroke. The way you learn to fly, quite simply, rising up and unsurprised. My meals come banging through a metal hatch. There is a puzzle of 1,000 pieces to complete. It seems impossible. The sky is all the same, with not a cloud in sight. And if I were to break it up and start again, would anything have changed? I think of these things as I pace the yard, remembering your slippery, coherent lies, the way they broke apart like new-laid eggs. You brought me coral beads from Africa. I wore them like the blood that shot in loops and spirals down my favourite dress, the colour that suffused the air each time you smiled, looking just past me to those secret coils, those rapturous transgressions. In 10 more years, I'll walk outside, thinking the day ordinary, warm or beautiful, able to touch the leaves, to examine a grain of sand. But understand, yes, I would, yes, would do the same again.
It's interesting that my response to that, you produce this marvellous, I think, murderous fantasy, which I think is about another person.
Shows you don't know me very well.
Well, apparently I know Beatrice, I know Caroline, but there's... what's her name?
But that's what's interesting about the unconscious, that actually you never get to the core of it. It's like the earth. You think you can sink boreholes, and you can go down a certain way, and dreams, of course, come up from a lair below the surface, but you never get to that boiling centre. And if you did, you'd be incinerated, and so would everyone else.
Well, I think I'm taking up your point, too, that the unconscious is constantly active, not separated, usually. When it is separated, then there is a problem.
Mm.
And that's much more like a neurosis. More it is when it permeates apparently conscious thinking and speech.
Mm.
And that was a big shift in psychoanalysis, don't you think? When largely through Klein's analysis of play and children, analysts began to listen to ordinary communications and associations as if they are dreams. In fact, in other words, to listen to the symbolic significance as well as the actual significance of ordinary speech, and to interplay the two. So it is, we're all intrigued, but you could do this backwards as a poet, it seems to me. It's a sort of like a thing in reverse to the analyst listening and doing it. So I go back to this thing. It's as if the starting point is so important, the positioning in relation to the thinking one is doing.
Yes.
Which in your case is sometimes completely subjective, such as you wish for in your cat poem. You wish you could be this cat poet at that moment, which just have subjective experience with no self-consciousness. At other times, you write about your subjective self, but as if viewing yourself at the same time. So you're sort of self-commentary as well as self, which slightly different positions. You move from one to the other very easily. I think we all at our best can do that, and it's what goes wrong psychologically for people when you can't do that, when you can't move from subjective self to observing self and back again to and fro. using the material, but the two are partitioned. And some people are stuck on one side of the partition and some stuck on the other. But
you have to allow time, don't you? I mean, time to grow and to develop. And I say this particularly because there was one event which I felt very deeply about, I'm sure everybody did, and that was 9/11. And I think Simon Armitage is an exception, but I don't think many poets managed to write about 9/11, certainly in the short term, with any success. I mean, I may not know all the poems, but over 20 years later, using that as a starting point a long time ago, I wrote something that I felt satisfied with. And I'll read it. Mm. It's just called Aftermath. And the starting point was a book review I read by Tim Dee, who's a poet and somebody who's very interested in birds, above all a writer. And he described the origin of the word aftermath as being the first grass that pushes its way through once the corn has been cut or the crop taken in. There's then a sort of first flush of grass. This poem is called Aftermath, and it's in two halves. The first half is actually about the event. Finally, the search is declared closed. The brilliant lights yellow and expire. The mechanical diggers fall quiet, folding awkwardly upon themselves, touching their knuckles gently to the rubble, old beasts preparing for the winter sleep. Beneath the crossed girders is held the mass for those who have never been found, the missing, the not known, the gone away. And the next day, the seeds and the pollen that blow through the city fall undisturbed, a slow veiling of this jumbled grave. What's left is what's not there, two phantom limbs, untouchable, aching, the body unassuaged. The voice said, cry. And the city answered, what shall we cry? And the voice answered, all flesh is grass, and all its beauty no more than the flowers of the field. Yet look at the meadow after the scythe has swept across it. See the mountainside after the beautiful catastrophe of fire. See the desert levelled by the sun's blank stare. Here is the aftermath. How days later, sparse, a few fine shoots of grass, shining and green, push through the cut swathes bleached dry by the sun. Though tender, they push aside the chaff. The flattened stalks reach for the day. This is the aftermowing, indestructible. The mountain scrub springs back, seeds burst, the nodes of grass divide, renew themselves. Their beauty is that of the generations. My young replace me. They resemble me and will also be different, seeding themselves across the world. Like grass, they carpet the earth. Ryegrass, fescue, sea oats, rush, bent grass, yarrow, foxtail, sedge.
There's a fox out there, interestingly, since you've written about foxes.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's caught my eye.
Yes.
I would say there's quite a lot of biology in that poem.
Just conscious of the time.
Sure.
Making it would be really helpful to perhaps get some responses or questions from people in the audience.
You used one of your Christian names for your role as an analyst and another for your role as a poet. Of course, they're linked quite appropriately by your surname, Garland. So I wondered how much you felt the analyst was in the poet and the poet was in the analyst.
Look, I never think about being a poet in the consulting room. It just doesn't happen.
Not consciously.
And I very occasionally realise that I'm thinking a psychoanalytic thought when I hear somebody else's poem, when I can... as Morris did very brilliantly with the Yeats poem, if you work at it, you can pick up the associations, the sound links, and the deeper meanings. Incidentally, I've got a thought about put on his knowledge and his power, but later. I've written one poem about work, which is a very knockabout poem, and it's called Audit, and it's extremely rude, as anybody who works in the public services might expect, about the hoops that we are now expected to jump through, and above all, the language that is used. Actually, I'm bloody well going to read it. Otherwise, it's all a bit about death and very serious. 11. Audit. I hate my boss. He's got a belly like a sack, full of something nasty, fermenting stew and bladder rack. He uses foul language prior to and over the moon and with reference to yours. Or, now then, my good lady, you're going to have to change your tune. I hate the way his eyes rotate behind his specs, like a chameleon after flies, tongue in all the cracks, relishing trouble, care packages, performance reviews, and customer satisfaction. All of it bad news. Who'd work for anyone who talked such bollocks? Fuck market forces. I'll live in a cardboard box. And if he comes looking, long time no see, I'll bag lady him to death with a shopping trolley. Questions.
If there's any NHS managers here, now is the time to stand up.
Wasn't written in an analytic session.
I just had a quick question. You said you thought of the unconscious as like a boiling core of fire. And I just wondered how does that fit to... I mean, maybe you think that when you work as a poet, because how does that fit to when you work as an analyst and the way psychoanalysis has kind of tried to map the unconscious and sort of organise it in some way or give you a map to work with anyway? I wonder if those two were contradictory or how you negotiated those frontiers.
Well, I have never assumed that I could analyse everything in a patient or that it is capable, that anybody is capable of having everything that is inside them brought up to the surface and laid open for inspection. And that's not because I'm afraid it's too hot to handle or to one would be incinerated by it. It's just not possible. Everybody has a private life and they may not always know about it in detail, but it's there. Wouldn't you think so, Ron?
Well, yes, I suppose I take a rather particular view, as you know, about the unconscious being structured, actually, into model, and which are then imposed on conscious perception and so on. So it's not, and even Freud's model is not all disorganized, goes through processes of organization, and it's that which we touch on, really. But the aim, after all, is for the knowledge eventually to belong to the patient, not the analyst.
Mm.
And hopefully one's interventions are to promote that process.
Yes. Yes.
A process of ultimately self-knowledge. And you could say the motto is get to know yourself.
Yes. And for the process of inquiry that go and thought that goes on in the session to come to be taken in by the patient so that it becomes their own, because it isn't as if all difficulties are going to end the minute the analysis is over and you're done, as it were. It, you know, life goes on, the difficulties go on, but you've got better equipment inside you, the hope is, for thinking about it, addressing it, struggling with it.
I wonder if the idea there is that we've put on your knowledge and power as the analyst and as the patient. And on that note, I think we'd all like to hear your insights, both as Caroline and Beatrice, on that 13th line, rather than you just sharing them with Maurice.
Well, Yeats could be quite grandiose. He had a very high opinion of himself, particularly, I mean, how deep that went, I don't know, but certainly I think he felt he was somebody who could bestow himself upon a woman and that she might be very flattered and grateful. And one of the meanings of put on, of course, you can put on an act, you can put on a performance, you can put on a cloak of some kind. And I wondered if he had somewhere in his unconscious the idea that the woman would be enhanced by his attention to her, that she would now put on his knowledge and his power, but he then, uninterested, casually, lets her drop, and of course she's then lost, or she's lost what she put on. So I thought there was a bit of vanity in that line.
Well, that's interesting, yeah.
I was also thinking, though, that drop is very linked to pregnancy. Falling pregnant is a phrase.
Mm.
And there we have a rape which results in a pregnancy. And with terrible consequences, I thought. So I wondered if Yeats didn't have some, talking about foreknowledge, anticipation of disaster, intergenerational disaster. The nature of the parental acts which give rise to the next generation have terrible consequences.
The drop, that is a revelation to me, actually, because that does bring it back to being the kind of historical poem again, doesn't it? Because it's an event dropped into, with consequence, into history. Okay.
I was thinking about a particular writer who was troubled by her many me's. And
me's, selves.
She acted in different perhaps forms. If anything can be gathered from about unconscious of a writer from her writing, I thought that all the me's, all the selves, were very well unconsciously married. I just wonder about she still saw it as a source of conflict. I just wonder whether you would like to comment on that.
Well, I don't know the writer you're talking about. It's not a source of conflict for me. I mean, as I get older and I do less analytic work and have more time for writing, but I feel that the two kinds of work are linked. First of all, they belong in the same person, even if, as Ron said, I go into different rooms, but they join somewhere in the unconscious, yes. And they are also, I think, linked as well by the importance of truthfulness. That is, emotional truth. That you can invent details or elaborate details, as I did in the Aftermath poem, but they've got to have a ring of more than plausibility. They've got to be truthful. And it's the same in analysis, that what you try to help the patient do is really know what they actually think and feel and are troubled by. So I would say no conflict.
Well,
thank you.
For you, no, but if I could just describe a patient that illustrates your point, I think, not a writer, for a long time. In analysis, she could never use the first person. She could never say I. She talked about me, and she talked about she. She was somebody who was a sort of foreign secretary, really, related to the outside world, and me was what she thought was her essential required self. When I pointed this out to her after quite a time, she said something which I always remembered. She said, I, and she was somebody who was very successful in business, she said, I would be the chair of the board, and there isn't a chair of the board. And there wasn't a chair of the board in this person, not for a long time, and that was the problem. So there is an I think, das Ich, which is the origin and what translated as the ego. There is an I, and that's what I think I was meaning when I said Caroline and Beatrice are very much one person. Isn't it? Don't feel I'm talking to a different person at all.
Good. I think on that note we're going to have to stop and thank you both very much for a really illuminating conversation.
Thank you, Ron.